welcome back.
I'm amazed that they didn't send you a finished book.
Well,
you
know, I tell you,
shame on them.
Dutton is not one of the best.
Good
in terms of their cooperation and trying to get material. If you hadn't sent me the copy, they never would have sent it.
Good heavens.
They never would have sent it. If I hadn't received it, I would have called them and asked.
I will call them since I get back to my office and make sure a copy comes over by messenger. You know, Harold Bloom is quoted on the back, and Don DeLillo and Ann Tyler. And
I usually like to see how they come out, because there are sometimes there are differences. And also, there are a whole bunch of blank pages.
There are. Oh, you have a bad one there.
Yeah, there are several. Well, there are.
You were on the list to get a first batch of finished books, and you never received them. Shocking.
I am used to working with publishers' publicity departments, and I would say that most of them are atrocious. There are some good ones. Coincidentally, and it's only a coincidence, I'm not saying this to you because you happen to be with Knopf, but Knopf probably has the best.
Yes.
Houghton Mifflin has an excellent one. Random House, which is, I guess, your parent, it's...
No, I know.
Doubleday is probably one of the worst in the industry.
Oh, and, shocking. Well,
Holt Reinhardt Winston, a CBS company up until recently at least, it's terrible. I could never get anything. I mean, I called and asked them for material, and I would never get it. So it's, I don't understand it. Maybe it's because they don't have training. I mean, some of these, they seem to be young women.
Yes.
And who seem to be oblivious to the necessity of promoting books.
Mm-hmm. And they don't follow through. They fail to make a note to themselves to do such and such, you know, at a certain period of time. Forgive me.
All right.
In any event, I will see to it that a copy is messengered over you tomorrow.
I would like to see the copy. I did, of course, enjoy the book. If enjoy is... the
word
term you use, I wasn't sure, but it is certainly consistent with Dear Mr. Capote and what I know so far, because you write so autobiographically, and yet there are things that maybe aren't autobiographical, and I'm never quite certain where the autobiography leaves off and the fiction begins. Maybe you could clarify that, or if it's possible to clarify that.
It's an easy question to speak to, because I would suspect that a chief aim of mine is to deliver the effect that the text is, in fact, scrupulously autobiographical. In fact, it's an old invention. But part of the fun, I think, in delivering a book is to see how close one can come to producing that very effect. There was certainly in the beginning of the history of the novel an attempt to convey the impression that these works were documents, that they were in fact authentic documents, largely because people felt that the novel was a frivolous undertaking and one ought to be reading fact and not fiction. What I'm trying to do, I suppose, in a kind of way, is to revivify that ambition and to convey what, in fact, are strictly fictions as if they proceeded directly from fact, from history. But indeed, the book Peru is entirely a work of imagination. It is a novel.
Well, in that respect, or maybe in less so, it's like What I Know So Far, one of the short stories in What I Know So Far, and in Dear Mr. Capote. In both of those books, in the What I Know So Far, in one of the chapters, there was an episode in which a young boy was killed in, I believe, a house under construction.
Yes.
And that also materialized in Dear Mr. Capote.
Yes, yes.
And I know from my previous discussion with you that that actually happened in your own existence, and you felt haunted by that. So it would not be inconsistent for this to have also been something that might have happened in your young childhood.
Absolutely. Indeed, there was an episode in my youth, a squabble over a sandbox. I think it had to do with how the play would proceed in the sandbox, and a boy banged me on the head with a shovel. in the course of that debate. And I think if there's any foundation in fact with Peru, there it is. In Peru, as you know, the narrator, who at the close of the novel is called Gordon, it's revealed that his name is Gordon, destroys a child, a neighbor child, with a toy hoe in the course of some play in a sandbox, in a neighbor's sandbox.
Well, of course, another way that you can throw off your listener, or reader rather, is that in your dedication page, you dedicate the book not only to your parents, and for Dennis Donahue, I don't know that who that is, but also to Stephen Michael Adanoff, who, of course, is in the fiction the victim of the attack by Gordon. Now, why did you do, was there really an Adanoff, or did you make this up to throw your reader off?
No, there's no one named Stephen Michael Adanoff, insofar as I am able to demonstrate. No, I certainly did check around on that name. The name Philip Lish and Regina Lish do indeed denote my parents, although the dedication doesn't say they're my parents. But when you get into the book, you hear the name Phil again and again, and you hear the name Reg. The assumption is that these indeed are my parents. My position is this. Dennis Donahue, incidentally, is the most distinguished critic who lives in Ireland and teaches here in New York some time of the year. My position is that everything within the covers of a book that is presented as fiction is indeed fiction, so that there's no reason why the dedication oughtn't to yield itself up to the very same kind of play that the text at large has. In this case, the dedication is indeed a part of the novel.
Okay, I accept that. Well, I think something that was interesting to me is the picture of childhood in that period, which I guess is the late 1930s. Is that correct? Did I have that right? Stated in here. I can't remember now.
38, 39, 40.
And it obviously takes place on Long Island.
Yes.
And there was an interesting reference where Gordon hears that somewhere out there in the neighborhood there are Christians.
Yes.
And he is afraid because I don't know what of, but apparently they were different.
Yes.
Was this the kind of experience that you had in your youth?
I must have had it, else I would not have thought of it. I mean, what Peru attempts in part to do is to delineate all the feelings and wild suppositions, confusions, ambitions that are present in a child of six. I think it's easy for us to forget how our minds at the age of six were suffusions of one lunatic notion after another. And largely all of it was shot through with ideas of magic. The little boy in Peru believes that he can manipulate the world through various magical incantations. He thinks that he, in fact, can rhyme all the words there are, and that in so doing he becomes a kind of god. I think one of the things we all feel when we're children is powerless, and one way, I suppose, that we have of mediating between our powerlessness and the power of the adult world is to ascribe to ourselves various magical powers. And these largely come, I think, through deceptions with the language, confusions with the language, through notions that the language, if repeated in various ways, if uttered in various ways, will yield up magical powers to us. Peru is about the separate provinces of power and of powerlessness, and how all of us as children tend to bridge those provinces with the only means we have available to us, for the most part, which is a notion that magic can happen, that we can manipulate the environment around us to bring things out the way we wish them to be. The speaker in Peru, the narrator in Peru, is a boy who lives next to a boy who has moderately more things, more wealth, it would seem. He may not be rich, in fact, this boy who's called Andy Lieblich, but he does seem to have more than the narrator has. And in an effort to equalize the relation between them, even though he, the narrator, young Gordon, feels nothing but affection, indeed adoration, for Andy Lieblich and all the things that have to do with Andy Lieblich, even so, he has a need in him to sort of establish himself on some kind of equal footing. And this he believes he does by being better at things in the sandbox than is Andy Lieblich. He's a good player of the game Farmer, which is the game he likes to play, a game where you fill up a pail with sand and then overturn it and attempt to keep all the sand in one piece as if it were to give the impression of a haystack. And Gordon's efforts to mediate the powerlessness he feels with his school teachers, with the men who come to clean the cesspool, with the Christians, with the boy next door, with the boy who comes, this boy Adenoff, who has a hare lip and whom he finally dispatches with a hoe, all are attempts to find a way to manage the world around him so that he is not absolutely bereft of power. And to a great extent, he does this through play, and he does it through imagining, and he does it through language, through various tricks of language that he has. He believes that, for example, that he knows where there is a secret sand in the sandbox, that down underneath the sand on the surface, there's a kind of sand which is denser and seems to be wet. Of course, it's not really wet. It's just drier or not less warmed by the sun. But he believes that he has the courage to put his hand down in the corner under the surface sand, down there where little crab-like things may be in the sand and could bite his fingers. But if he can only secure that sand, you see, then he can make a haystack out of his pail that will withstand that will hold together in a way that Andy Lieblich's and Stephen Adenoff's would not, because they don't have the courage to go down underneath the surface of the sand. Now, of course, all this is preposterous, but none of it is preposterous to a six-year-old. And I think if we can recapture, which is virtually impossible to do, of course, and thank goodness, I suppose, that that's the case, if we could recapture the full measure of what it was that we thought and felt and believed when we were six, we would be overwhelmed with the richness of that texture. Just the other day, I heard someone say, "Oh, he's not my cup of people." And I can recall, of course it was a mistake, but it put me in mind of an apprehension that I had had when I was a little boy. Of just the same kind, of people saying cup of people. I didn't understand cup of tea. He's not my cup of tea. I didn't understand that. And I really saw people in a cup in some kind of way, or a person in a cup. We all of us know how children misapprehend hymns and songs and pledges of allegiance and all that sort of ceremonial language of youth. And that's to a great extent what Peru is about. I can recall when I was a boy hearing adults say that this or that child might or might not get there. And get there to them had to do with a kind of success that could be measured. I don't know how I got this notion in my head, but get there seemed to me to be something to do with Florida. You got there when you went to Florida. Florida was there. And so that all through my early youth, I had the notion that people who went to Florida, in fact, got there, and that people who did not never did get there, and that one of the ends of adult life was to find oneself in Florida. I put this before you because, to a great extent, it's a theme present in the book that I'm working on now, the novel I'm working on now. But it seems to me that this really is what we are when we're five and six and seven. We are collections of masses of misinformation, immense misinformation. There's very little in our lives that is real. It's all really magic. And this boy, Gordon, who tells us the story of Peru, is a boy who's overcome with misinformation and who believes himself possessed of magical powers. And when he speaks to us as an adult who has, as you know, suffered the witnessing of a horrid event on television and then the following day is involved in a sort of farcical accident with a taxi cab. What he's put in mind of is, through the hysterical event that is brought about by these two experiences, what he's seen on television. He's seen a piece of violence on late-night television, some news footage, and the next day, in the course of his hurrying along to get his boy off to summer camp, he suffers an accident with a sort of ludicrous accident with a taxi cab. It all puts him in mind of an experience in his youth, which may or may not have really happened. What we do know is that indeed he did live next door to a boy who seemed to have more than he had. He did have a great affection for a school teacher. It is interesting to observe that that teacher's name is Donnelly, and one of the persons dedicated, persons who, to whom the book is dedicated is named Donahue. Both are extremely tall. Much is made of that. There are a lot of parallels of this kind in the book. The book, as you may know, is shot through with these mirrorings. The hair lip that is in place in the boy who is the victim of the bludgeoning occurs to the speaker as wet and pink looking, and this evokes the sex play that the boy has had down in the cellar with his neighbor's sister, as it does invoke the boy's notion of what's underneath the shoe that his father wears. His father wears a strange shoe, and it's only off when the boy is in the shower with the father, but he's afraid to look and see what it is. He's convinced it will be wet and pink-looking, and that something comes off it called cess, and that cess goes out into the so-called cesspool outdoors where the men have come to see to things.
Well, you said a moment ago that children are filled with misinformation when they're 5 and 6. That's true, but there's a plus side to that, because as one becomes older and the years add on to your life, I think images become less distinct. And I know that I can look back in my childhood when I was 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and see images so vivid. I can remember these details so well. I'm not sure that I'm almost 50. I'm not sure that I can remember as clearly the things that happened to me last year and the year before, 5 years ago, as well as I could, well as I can, my childhood. And isn't that the same with all of us?
Oh, yes, indeed. I'm absolutely certain this is the case. I'm certain, too, Don, that anything that you feel is true of yourself is true of all of us. I think that we are alive to ourselves, and the world is alive to us in ways when we are ages of that kind that are never replicated again in life, that we begin to move farther and farther away from ourselves. Certainly in the execution of Peru, it was clear to me when I began to think back to what life was in fact like for me when I was these ages, how vivid all those experiences were. They don't show up in the book, but the vividness is behind them, so that I knew that when I went forward with the book, I had to make all of this boy's world extremely vivid to the reader, because life was like that for us. First of all, it was not cluttered with so very much. We had so much less on which to concentrate. This is a boy who, when he goes to school, hears the corduroy whale, the whale in his corduroy pants making a sound, and that's a voice to him, and it talks to him. He feels he has a companion on his way to school and his way home from school. That would not be present for us at the ages we are now, Don, because our minds are cluttered with the business of the day. If we were walking from home to the office, we'd think about all the things that must be done at the office.
And
all
yet,
the things that
once in a while, you'll be walking in the suburbs, and there will be somebody burning a fire, and there's an odor that comes, an odor that you haven't smelled for 40 years. But you remember smelling that same odor when you were 10 years old?
Certainly the genius of Proust, I know. Certainly the genius of Proust. And this is a boy who remembers things that way. He remembers his mother and his teacher and his friends in relation to their smells. He remembers the boy next door in respect of the cocoa butter smell his hair had and the citronella smell his body had. I didn't even know I could remember something like citronella until I put my mind to it. I don't think anybody I ever smelled particularly strongly of citronella any more than I did.
I'm not sure I ever smelled it. I'm not even sure I know what it is.
Well, citronella was a rather commonly used material substance to keep off flies and fleas and mosquitoes in my youth. There were two palliatives for the problem. One was citronella, and the other was punk. One burned a substance, heaven knows what it was, but you lit it, and it smoldered very much
that
like incense. And you held it aloft.
I remember rubbing a material. I lived in the Midwest and in Texas, and we had terrible mosquito problem. And I remember rubbing greasy material, but I never knew the name of it.
Oh, that was probably a citronella. There's an oil base to it.
You also play a trick on your reader outside of the episode apparently takes place in Peru, which Gordon sees as an adult on television, the violence on the roof of this building. This book has nothing to do with Peru. I'm sure that you're going to find some of our Latin American friends who is going to be grabbing this up to read all about Peru, and they're going to be disappointed.
Well, Peru, it seemed to baffle the reviewer for the New York Times what the intention and the title was. It did not baffle other readers of the book. It's fairly straightforward. There are two exotic place names in the book, Togoland, which is where the taxi driver comes from, in the farcical episode near the end of the book, or really all the way through the book, since the book is built in that fashion. And Peru, and if either of these places is intended to mean anything other than what they very lexically mean in the book, it's that there are places where exotic things do happen all the time. There are places where people don't speak the language of Spanish, they speak the language Peruvian. There's a place to go when he's in the taxi cab at the end of the book, and he feels he's escaping all of the tedium of the quotidian. This accident has happened, he's banged his head, and suddenly life has come apart for him, and he's going to race away from all these entrammeling circumstances to something freer, something more like childhood, where the exotic things can happen, something like Togoland, some place he doesn't know a thing about. So all the Peru is intended to suggest here is a place where things are magical again and exotic again, where strange, unexplainable things happen, where people shoot each other and at the same time stab each other and seem to be enjoying doing it. That's what he's seen on television. He seems to see in this news footage of a prison break, he seems to see a kind of reciprocity in the violence, as if it were almost a sexual experience, a dance involving a giver and a taker, willingly, a kind of connivance between the two. And where he wants to go is a place that brings back all that strangeness. If you recall, when he's young, he thinks about the neighbor's house, the Lieblich's house, as if it were a kind of castle, very much like the castles that are shown him in the picture book that Miss Donnelly shows pictures of to the kids in class. And he thinks that the Lieblich's are like royal people who can come down from their turret and reach out their hands into the walls and dig out handfuls of edible stuff. It's all candy. Their lawn is candy. Their house is candy. Life is like that. Indeed, I don't think that's a terribly strange notion either. I think when I was a child, I often had the feeling that things were edible, that were not edible. I would look up and see in some place I'd never been before, a white building. And I would think that there was somehow like whipped cream, or somehow like ice cream, that there was a strange building that it couldn't, in fact, be consumed. Maybe it was just marzipan, you see. But it was edible. In any event, Peru is simply to suggest this kind of place where all the things that represent the strange admixture of fact and fantasy and youth, of horror and wonder, of truly the awesome, are suffused with each other, or they mix with each other, they cannot be separated, and it's a better place by implication. However horrible and however however horrible, it's a better place than the place he's living in now, where he has to squabble with his wife over whether we take a taxi cab or not, or whether we carry the trunks down, and whether we buy a black and white television, or and so on and so forth. So that Peru is a place to fly away to. And at the end of the book, in the episode in the taxi cab when he in fact is en route to the emergency room of the hospital. He has a feeling that the cab is lifting up off the highway, off the street, and that he isn't somehow being released from all that holds him down in this adult life he now has.
Well, one last thing I want to ask you about. Reading Peru shows me that you have not abandoned your obsession with words and with the way things sound. Certainly you've done that in your other books, and Peru is a classic example of that. So apparently, for you at least, Gordon Lish, there's not going to be anything as a so-called straight book.
No, I hope not. I certainly hope not. I'm working on a novel now that I began really before I began Peru. I've been at it for about 4 years now. I don't expect I'll produce another novel after this one. I hope it won't be like anything anyone's ever done before, including me. And there'll be a short collection of stories as well. But I would hope that each time I do come to the page, that I come to it with enough strength to make the page different from the page that I've just come to.
Well, I hope all this writing is not cutting into the your editing work over at Knopf.
I still do that. I still work as an editor at Knopf, and I hope to do so until they push me out the door, and I continue to teach at Columbia and NYU and my private master class. And all these things really are activities, Don, which I think abet one another. I don't think that, in contradistinction to what the usual complaint is, that time away from my writing, doing my teaching or doing my editing, is time which I pay a price for. In fact, I think it inures to the benefit of my writing. Every time I'm in touch with my students and illuminate for them something, it's an illumination for me as well. And the same thing is true of my writers at Knopf. It all is a piece to me.
Well, your work is an illumination for me as well as your presence here, because I've always enjoyed talking to you and finding out how you think and how you work. So it's important for me. And so I know we'll be joining forces again to talk about subsequent books. And I thank you very much for spending this half hour with me.
Don, you're immensely kind. Thank you.